This week we tackled the first week of school for both of our kids. Sherry is taking a licensure exam so she can be a licensed psychologist in Minnesota. And we found ourselves at the state fair last night with Derek, my co-founder with Drip, and I being chased by a giant slice of bacon. And as a bonus, we'll include a photo of that event on the post for this episode. Today we're replaying one of our most popular interviews. It's an interview with Heaton Shaw done for our Founder Origin series. This was a series that was, I think it went from about episode 13 to episode 18, give or take. And pretty incredible story to hear Heaton go through the support he received from his father, losing his mother at a young age, and his early interest in computers, and how that later led to him being one of the most recognized SaaS founders in our circles. And we'll be back next week with more original content. I hope you enjoy it.
We plan to talk through the issues faced by startup founders and the people close to them.
Overused phrase, work-life balance.
It is an amazingly focusing time.
This is what we do, you know, aside from our families, this is our whole work life.
I am also known as Dr. Wine.
You know, this is a little bit non-traditional.
A little more zen in the startup life than founder.
Those days were a mental struggle.
I have been stressed in the past, and I know that I will be in the future.
A founder and his or her significant other would both get value from the episode.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, of course.
You are aware, I think, that we're doing this Zen Founder podcast and talking about issues related to the lives of founders that are not necessarily techniques, but more lifestyle and wellness.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've been curious about and one of the things that I'd love to talk to you about is sort of where do founders come from? Asking people to reflect back on their early lives, their childhoods, and just see what kinds of different stories people have that lead them to this place. So maybe just start by, best you can, kind of describe who you were as a little guy, as a kid.
So I was actually born in Africa, and that's relevant because by the time I was five, we had moved to New York. And my dad, he, from my understanding, from what he told me, he applied to literally 1,000 jobs. He's a physician, and that was to get to this country. But now I'm going to tell you why he did that. So since I was born, my mother had cancer. So she got it literally after I was born. That's when she was diagnosed, I believe.
Right after you were born. Okay.
And I had known, they told me about it as early as they thought they could tell me. So whether it was a year or two, I don't think anybody remembers now, but they were telling me. And they were very...
So it was never a surprise or a shock.
No
surprise. It was part of your life.
No surprises there. So I think that's kind of different because I actually have a friend whose father got cancer really quickly and they wouldn't even let him go to the funeral and stuff. So I think to protect him. And my dad was the exact opposite of that. He's like, for lack of a better word, I think he's like full transparency, just know what's going to happen, right? And this will happen. So the reason we wanted to get to the U.S. is so that my mom could get better treatment.
Wow.
And we were very lucky here, but he ended up getting a job at Sloan Kettering Memorial Cancer Center in New York. On 72nd in New York, that's actually where I used to live, and the hospital was a few blocks away. And so we lived there. And so I would hear stories from him growing up about all kinds of stuff. But he's a physician, and my mother was a physician as well. They're both anesthesiologists. And this kind of stories he'd tell me were even though he was a doctor, everyone around him was not a doctor, and they were businessmen. There's even a crazier story. When they heard my dad was moving to Africa to get a job and work at this hospital, they gave him a person's, this is so classic, it's so weird, but it really happened. They gave him a name and a phone number. Said, when you get there, find this person. And that family is the closest family to us now.
Wow.
And has always been. And that's actually the friend whose parents and brothers didn't let him go to their dad's funeral. And that dad was the one my dad contacted that he had the note from.
Hmm.
And that's where a lot of it started, I would say, for our family. In the sense of we were very close to that family. There's another family we're close to. And oftentimes my dad would tell me, even today when I meet somebody that's a family friend, he'd be like, oh, do you remember them from Africa or whatever. I'm like, I was five. I was God, you know, I don't know, right? And, but like, I remember the names and stuff. Like, it's really weird. Like, the names are familiar for some reason. But my dad tells a lot of stories, or he used to. And so I'd hear stories of him helping these businessmen through travels. Like, he loved to drive. I liked to drive as well, probably because of him. And he would drive. He'd be the driver. Like, just because I think it was fun for him. I don't know exactly why.
So businessmen would visit from abroad, and they'd come to where you were. Where were you in Africa?
And even the ones there. Actually, there's a lot of export-import stuff going on. And there was a lot of different... It was Ndola, Zambia. So there's a lot of different, like, countries and states and stuff all around there. And they were driving back and forth, actually, just between those countries and states and whatever it is in Africa. And my dad would always volunteer to drive if he had the opportunity, just because he liked it. So I'd hear stories about that. From there, he'd tell me stories about their businesses and stuff like that. In fact, there was a company called Nillions, which was... That family, he got the note from somebody to go contact, and I still, like, have their spoons from their company. They're still my favorite, and I still have them. I actually stole them from my dad's house. Not stole them, but I took them. He doesn't care. He just probably doesn't even remember it. But I know those spoons, and those are my favorite spoons. Anyways, whatever. And I don't know why. It's, like, weird, but, like, I just remember this, and they're still my favorite spoons. But anyways, he also would tell me stories about himself and how, like, anytime someone needed help from a physician or medical help, he would always be there and go there and help them. Like, just, it didn't matter, as long as it was a friend, friend of a friend, or anybody. And back then in Africa, I think there's probably something that made him, they called him Doc, actually. They actually literally called him Doc because of that. And he'd just go help anybody, anytime anyone needed any help. So, like, and he's an anesthesiologist, so he's not, like, a general practitioner or anything, but he'd find ways to go help them. Even to this day, that's carried over with me, which is, like, when we have somebody, like, on any of our teams, or even a good friend of mine, so teams in our company are a good friend of mine, and there's, like, a condition or anything like that, I'm immediately like, let me just get those reports or those papers, and my dad, he'll go find somebody and just take a look at it and give you an opinion.
My dad will help you.
Yeah. So I still do that. He's down, whatever.
So what happened with your mom? So you moved, your family moved to New York so she could get better care. Yeah. Did she recover? Did she?
So when I was 8, she actually passed away.
Okay.
But what's interesting is, again, growing up, I saw this. She passed away in her own bed, surrounded by everyone she knew. Hmm. Like, the house was full. That's all I remember. Right? And I think I had been so tuned to, like, not waiting for the day or knowing the day was coming, but, like, I didn't cry that day. Hmm. And it's not because I think I was strong or my dad was strong. It's just that everyone else was crying. Hmm. So there's no point to cry.
You didn't,
that was what I remember.
Need to write that.
Yeah, something like that, right? So it's kind of weird. I do remember that. I remember actually talking to my dad about it that day. I don't remember what we said. But the interesting thing from a founder, entrepreneur, whatever perspective is, by the time I was 5, he would tell me that I should be an entrepreneur. And his reasoning was, you don't really have a ceiling if you're an entrepreneur. Like, you get to make your own calls and your own choices and stuff like that. That was an interesting one. I agree with him, obviously. But I think in America and the U.S. in general, it's probably not the same. Like, if you really want to get something done, even if you're not a founder, you could probably figure it out. Like, there's probably some cap, but it's a little bit different, I would say, than what he thought. But the part that I thought was even more interesting that probably shaped a lot of my thinking, even to this day, is he said he doesn't use his brain as a physician. And that was one of the reasons he suggested, or not even suggested, told me to be an entrepreneur.
What do you think he meant by that?
So he said that, like, everything he does ends up being, he didn't say it like this, but it's really, like, as I thought about it and think about it now, it's like muscle memory.
You follow the policy or follow what you're taught more than it's creative.
Or what you've done.
Okay.
Right? And so the creativeness at some point, like, it just dies out. That's why he still does research and he still likes teaching people, like teaching students, like residents and stuff like that. And he never got into private practice because I think he would have probably thought that was even more boring.
From the beginning, the beginning that you remember, he was encouraging your entrepreneurship.
He even tries to say it's earlier. You might have thoughts on this considering your profession. I don't remember anything about my childhood. Even today, like, even high school, like, if someone starts talking about it, it all comes back, right? Like, any like, period that's probably past the last, I want to say, 60, 90 days, I need a trigger, and then it all comes back. But if I don't have a trigger, it doesn't come back.
Like, it's not readily accessible.
Yeah.
It needs to be cued somehow.
Yeah. Even high school was cued the other day because I met with someone who I went to high school with. So I don't know what that means or why that happens. Yeah.
If I could, I mean, if this is okay territory, I mean, you mentioned...
Any territory is okay.
I mean, you mentioned, you know, not necessarily crying the day that your mom passed.
Yeah.
But what was that like for you in the years following? How did her not being there or her loss shape you?
Yeah, so we're going to get into the complexities, not of my emotion, but more of, I think my dad set it up a certain way. So when he knew that she was basically a terminal illness and wasn't going to get better, like, we had macrobiotic books everywhere and, like, stuff. So they tried really hard in all kinds of ways. She survived for, I guess, 8 years. Wow. Basically, right? So she survived a long time. This was in the 80s when I don't think that was heard of. So it was probably her will more than anything else. But by the time she heard that, my dad had actually uprooted his parents from India, moved them to Africa. And so I grew up with them, my mom with cancer, and him. And then we moved to New York, and actually my mom's brother was in D.C. and was around, and so was my mom's sister and their family. So it wasn't like weekly, but it was like monthly. We probably saw them and stuff like that.
So he set it up that you had a lot of other
adults. It gets even deeper than that. He actually remarried. And my understanding, and I'm pretty sure knowing him it is true, is that he remarried somebody because of me so that I'd have a mother around. Mm-hmm. Even though I had these grandparents and he had uprooted them, right? And it goes even deeper in that he had such a strong obligation that, but he ended up getting divorced. So we moved to California with her. She was cool to me, like as good as anyone could be for someone who's not their kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I had no issues, but they definitely had a whole bunch of issues.
It wasn't the right relationship.
It wasn't the right relationship. And I doubt he did it for the right reason for himself, but he thought he was doing it for the right reason for me, which is to some extent probably true, right? Cause it's not like she did anything to me except do her best. Right. And I can't even remember a time when she didn't. I probably was worse to her than she was to me. They got a divorce. And then in high school, my grandfather passed away. He passed away at home as well. So there's like a trend here. Just because I think my dad being a physician, his take has been not to prolong life unnecessarily, so to speak, so that the other person's in pain, meaning the person going.
Sure.
Because you're generally prolonging life for the people that are alive, not the people that are going.
Yeah.
Just generally. Right. And these are things that, like, I think he had some kind of cancer, right? So it was something that wasn't curable, and they tried and all that, but, like, he wasn't going to go through crazy radiation or anything. He was old
and
man. You know,
they decided not to do the drastic measures to keep someone alive, but to let them go.
So that's his take on it. I'll get back to the entrepreneurial stuff. There's one more on this, which was interesting because, so my grandma was there. We actually lived where we lived because there's a Jain, we're Jain, that's our religion, and there's a Jain temple like 3 or 4 miles away. So we lived there more than for anyone else because of her. And I think his obligation to her for uprooting her at that point, like 20, 30 years ago or whatever, 20 years ago.
Was that she was going to be able to live somewhere where she could worship.
His life,
her
literally, he has this thing he did, and I think that's what made me probably not messed up. He has this thing he does where it's like he will accommodate that other person, but yet be totally cool with it. And be accommodating of himself. So he'd make sure she had rides to the temple. Like, literally, he'd even do things on his life, tweak them a little bit here and there just to accommodate her needs.
He takes care of people.
Yeah, like, probably to an extreme that I learned from. This is the extreme it goes to, and I'll go back to the other stuff. He got married again at 60. And what I say about that is that until my grandmother passed away, he wasn't going to get married. Because his obligation to her was so strong,
like,
that anyone else couldn't fit into that.
He didn't really have time and space in life for another person to take care of.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's my understanding. It was like literally the moment she basically passed away, it was like she was getting a stent in and didn't work out, right? Not that he got married right away, but like he started seriously dating and all that. He did date here and there, but never, like, it was always, like, respectful of her. So I think the way to describe that would be he was overly respectful of her. Not even overly, to an extreme where I just don't see that often.
Hmm.
And I think he did that to me, too.
Hmm.
Always trying to accommodate, you know, with the getting married even though he shouldn't have, getting the grandparents over before that.
Making sure you were taken care of.
Yeah, regardless of anything.
And how did that translate into you entering the computer world and the startup world? Was that your interest early on, or was that his?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think he was probably also, if he can take care of me, he probably already understood a lot of stuff about me that I might not even understand today myself, but more intuitively. So I was taking apart stuff all the time, breaking it, phones, everything. It was just an interesting time back then when, like, it wasn't code you cared about. It was, like, these things that sat there, and you're like, wait, they work? It's the phone? And, like, we watched the rotary thing and then the dialing thing. And, like, I saw those, and I'm like, why does this one do that? And it's not like I even I'm not even one to go so deep into it where, like, I want to go build a phone or anything, right? It was just interesting to break it apart and to see what's inside.
You were curious.
Yeah, more than anything else, really, right? Curious. And I had a screwdriver. So,
right? That
was it.
Wow.
That was it.
I sort of fear that happening in my household.
Exactly, right? So that's what I had, and he was very encouraging. In fact, I only had two rules growing up, which probably stemmed from all this kind of stuff. Actually, one. If you're in trouble, you call me. I had no other rule. Mm-hmm. I'm your first call. That was the only rule I had. And the times when I didn't do that, I actually, those were not good situations. Then I'd make fun of him. I'd get like a speeding ticket at like 2 a.m. or something, and I'd call him.
Anyways, I'm in trouble,
yeah,
Dad.
Yeah, but I wasn't in trouble. But I'm like, hey, you told me to call you, right? But that was the only rule I had growing up. So no curfew, no nothing like that.
That's amazing. I mean, yeah. It's...
So I think that has something to do with it.
The level of connection and openness between you.
Yeah.
And you essentially growing up in a situation where you had very little cause for shame.
Yeah.
Or needing to hide or feel bad about it. I mean, it sounds like you were really, really loved.
Yeah. I had probably more freedom than any kid that I could think of. My wife still gives me a hard time about that.
Did you?
She didn't have as much.
And you used it well, it sounds. I mean, did you?
I got in a lot of trouble.
Okay.
I got in a lot of trouble.
I'm curious about that. What kind of trouble did you get in, Ian?
I started drinking when I was 12.
Wow.
Right? Got caught multiple times. And that was with my friend who was our closest family friend. His father had died when he was about 8, 9, about the same time my mother died. But those are the same people we had met in Africa. Had like shown my dad everything about Africa and, you know, involved him in the community. I even went to college with this guy and was his roommate for a couple of years. He's an alcoholic, so I got to watch that probably. So I'm not an alcoholic. He probably still is, right? But we both started drinking around 12.
And
yeah, to commiserate.
Yeah. Why? Like for the fun, for boredom?
Mostly fun.
For
me, it was fun. For him, I think this is my theory. I'm not a professional like you, but I think he can get over the fact that they didn't let him go to his dad's funeral. And he's never going to get over that. It's just, maybe he has now, I don't know. But
you recognize that as a big deal, a big wound.
I think that was a wound for him. His family had alcoholism and stuff, mine doesn't.
Yeah.
Right? The other thing on kind of the entrepreneurial side, which I did want to mention, and I think it's definitely made me think about things differently, is, so my dad was a physician, or is a physician, and an anesthesiologist, but he also, it'd be rare to see him home until pretty late in the evening, because he'd go to work, and then after that, he'd go try to do, like, nonprofit type stuff. So since we moved to Southern California, about 13 or 14, he basically took over the health camp that our temple was doing, and now he does health camps, free ones, all the way from, like, eye exams, dental, to mammograms, pap smears and stuff like that, blood tests, all free, no matter who you are, whether you have insurance or not. And you do that in the U.S., and then he's been more recently, in the last, I think, 5 or 6 years, going all over the world doing free health camps. So I had to help when I was a teenager. So from about 12 to when, maybe right about 17, when, like, I didn't really need to help because I could get away because I had a car and everything.
But you had a job to do in the family that...
Yeah, it was an obligation.
Serious.
I watched him do the health fair. So this is like getting physicians to come in and do it, managing all that. He'd do all that. He'd run them, organize them, get them going, and I got to watch and help. I was like his right-hand dude, basically.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that was very interesting. So I saw that. I think that leads to probably a little bit about how I think about people and organizing things. Like I went to a wedding recently, good friends of mine. It was like a 30, 40-person wedding. They called me the CEO of the wedding. But it stems from childhood, because, like, it's not just the health fair, but, like, if we went somewhere, like, even someone's funeral or something, we would help no matter what. Like, just, what can we do? We're not just going to sit there and anything. Like, you name it, a wedding, that, like, especially with someone closer that we felt, like, okay to do that.
So that's part of family culture. It sounds like it's also part of your faith culture.
Yeah, definitely.
It's pretty important.
Yeah, the principles there are, like, nonviolence, trying to be non-judgmental, stuff like that. You know, I used to say I think my dad's probably the most egoless person that I can imagine.
Mm.
So I only aspire to be like that. I can't do that the way he does. So yeah, so since I was breaking apart stuff when I was, I think it was like 7 or 8, he'd come home from work in New York and then we'd actually go back to the hospital. And he told me this like recently. He's like, I don't know what you do, but you just play with those computers.
Huh. So he'd set you up at his desk or like, some desk and...
There was a lot of computers there.
There's a lot of interesting stuff there. You didn't bring your screwdriver, though, huh?
No, I did. In fact, we then had a computer by 8, I think, at home, and I'd break it all the time, and then the IT guy from there would help me fix it. So it was like, it's also the time when, like, computer stuff was, like, so fascinating, because it was, like, 8088, 8086, 286, 386, 486, Pentiums, like, all that was just coming up, right?
Taking off. What was your first entrepreneurial endeavor?
I sold car parts in high school so I could fund fixing up my own car.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was
all
sales,
specifically that. So I got a wholesale license to buy the parts wholesale. Mm. Yeah. Because that's the only way you can get them cheap.
So where would you go to get parts?
It's just like, if you have a wholesale license,
okay,
anyone will give you the parts.
Okay.
You can buy them. You buy them wholesale and you make some money, stuff like that.
So I hear these themes in a lot of these conversations, the curiosity, the early exposure to computers, and the freedom and space and time to just mess around.
Yeah.
So you had access to it, but you didn't have a parent who was like, don't touch that, don't break that, don't. There was freedom. Figure it out.
Yeah.
It's okay to break it.
I don't think I ever even heard those words.
Hmm. Did you hear?
I don't remember even him yelling at me for anything.
Did you ever hear no?
No.
Huh.
Never a no. Like, I'm trying to think of a no, and I never heard a no from him.
So you were really trusted to have your own decision-making and your own kind of moral compass, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you figured out the boundaries of that and how to use it when you were going through high school.
I went to our equivalent of a church, right, and the Jane classes, and I'm sure that influenced me, although I didn't realize it, because I was either class clown or most disruptive. Right? But something sunk in, I think.
Yeah.
But, like, that was only, like, anything formal. He never gave me anything formal. He did insist I go to it. So as long as I couldn't drive or had control over it, I'd go to it. But outside of that, I didn't get anything. In fact, like, I say no to him a lot. Like, I'm always ready to say no to him. Just because he never said no to me. So it's like...
Do you sort of wish you'd heard no more? Would there have been any value in that for you?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
No, I'm more than thankful for the no-nos. In fact, I'm scared that my kid's going to hear a lot of no's.
I mean, that sounds like a setup
me,
to
though.
Be an entrepreneur.
I feel like
curiosity
you
that you and honor. And then, I mean, you were kind of raised to have some trouble in a very strict 9-to-5 kind of job. I don't know how that ever would have worked for you, given how you grew up.
Oh, yeah. I had one internship, and even that was crazy, but it was in high school, and that's the only job I've ever had. And it was at a medical devices company that was started by a friend of my dad's in his garage. And it was a large company by then in high school, but that's all I did. I don't even know why I did it. I think it was a favor to my dad that the guy gave me the job. It was in their IT department. I don't think I provided any value to them. I did go in every day. I took the company picture.
There's evidence that you were there.
Yeah, there's evidence, yeah.
And it sounds like you also had a really rich upbringing in terms of relationships. You had these family friends, you had this extended family.
Lots of stories.
Had a lot of connection.
Lots of stories. Went to India quite a bit because that's where our extended family is. Know a lot of the folks there, like they know me, which was interesting. I still know them. And this was pre-Facebook and all that, so it's like I actually
You had to put in
there.
Some effort to...
But even then, like, my dad can't stand still, so, like, every day to two, we'd be in a different city with somebody new, a friend of his, right? Meeting them, talking to them, whatever he needs to do.
That sounds like you. I mean, I don't know you well, but that sounds like
pretty much
you.
The same. Yeah.
You're kind of imitating that part of
it. I try to be home as much as possible, but yes, totally imitating it. Like even like as I was growing up in high school, we'd have dinner pretty late if he was going to come for dinner. Otherwise, he might not come for dinner, and it was normal. And he was just out doing his thing, whatever his thing was. And I do definitely mimic that.
There was never angst about, does he love you enough? You know, it sounds like there was enough quality time.
Yeah, all those kind of things. Like, no. Like, just like the no-nos. I can only remember one time he got mad. I don't even remember what it was. And I was really young. And he didn't even get mad. My mom got mad at me for something I did to him. He didn't get mad. Mm-hmm. Even, like, when we got caught drinking, like, I can't remember him raising his voice about it.
What did he do when you got caught drinking? How did he handle that?
Apparently remember, but it, like, let's put it this way. I can't even remember what he did because I don't think he did anything that was memorable. Like, it's not like he didn't care. It's so weird. Like, I never even felt like I couldn't, because we got caught multiple times, like, I never even felt like I couldn't do it again, which is really weird. It's almost like, you know,
knew it was sort of wrong to begin with.
It's actually interesting now that I think about it, and you're making me dig deeper into that. When you think about a team member in your company, you want someone who, when they make a mistake, they're more mad than you can be.
Yeah.
And that you ever would be at them. And I have the pleasure of working with those many people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how he treated me. But you screwed up. Well, you know you screwed up, right? And he didn't even say stuff like this. So that's like...
And he didn't have to tell you.
No.
You already know.
No, it wasn't even a look.
Yeah.
It was like, you know what it was? You know what it really was? It was not even the fear of him. It was the fear of disappointing him. That's all that drove it.
Yeah.
It wasn't even the fear of him. It was the fear, the idea of even disappointing him. That's actually what probably got me more than any fear he could instill. Mm-hmm. Like, it was like a natural fear of, like, I don't want to disappoint that guy.
I mean, even in the way you talk about it now, I suspect that's very true still, that you have such high regard for who he is as a person that you're not trying to prove something to him, but you continue to try to...
Yeah, and I don't know the difference between trying to prove and not disappoint, because, I'm not trying to prove anything to him, but not even afraid is the wrong word, but I will be disappointed in myself if I think he's disappointed in me.
You'd really rather not disappoint him.
Yeah, that's what it is. It's not a fear, it's more like, I don't know how you created that. Challenging.
I mean, how are you carrying that over into your own parenting with your little guys?
I don't know. I don't know. I usually carry it over when, he'd tell me, you should do this with your son. Like, Dad, I don't see how that matters. Like, I'll tell him stuff like that because, he never, would do certain things with me except a few of these things. And I'm I don't really connect with you telling me what I should have do with my kid. So I think for me, it's like, and my wife had a different experience where her dad is very strict, right? And, he's had to get used to me not caring about a lot of things. Like, I don't really care if my car's dirty. Like, on the outside. Inside, I do. I have to drive it, whatever. He washes it, though, because he cares that much. Like, and it's not even he washes it for me. He's washing it because he doesn't want to see it dirty.
Right?
He knows
that.
He knows I won't do it. If I get a parking ticket, they actually go to his house because the cars are just registered there.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper tax, whatever. My wife manages finances. I just go with it. And he gets mad at her that I got a parking ticket. I'm in San Francisco. I get a lot of parking.
Everybody gets
parking. What do you want me to do, right? And I try not to, but so anyways, my bigger fear is that, or not even fear, but I think challenge is she's definitely going to be the strict one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how a mother-father balance works. I really don't.
You haven't really
I'm very biased and skewed. Yeah, and my grandparents, they definitely took care of me, but it was all just tactical. Take me to school, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure I got values from them, but it was not the same as a mother. So that's probably where I'm most nervous is because, I would love for my kids to have the kind of freedom I did. I don't think they're going to. So then I have to figure out ways to, I think, give them that. That's my theory.
To give them what you are uniquely equipped to give them while still being a good partner to your wife.
That's right.
Who will not appreciate being undercut, I'm sure.
Oh, and I won't.
Sure.
Because I'm respectful of her, and I think... Yeah. I'll give you one more to spin your head around if you want.
Sure. Spin away.
We started dating when we were 15, my wife and I. And by the time I was 17, I'd hold her belly and say my baby's going to be in there.
Wow.
I have no idea why. No rhyme or reason.
Do you want an interpretation?
Of course I do.
I think especially a little boy who grows up without a mom is really geared toward finding that partner and making a family. I mean, that seems like a little bit of longing for something that you may have wanted when you were a little guy.
That's right.
Yeah, but it sounds like it's worked out.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
You got two babies.
No complaint. Two babies.
I mean, the mom piece is interesting, if we could talk about it a little more.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, the word that comes to mind as you talk about this is resilience. The idea that you have, as a young person, encountered a really significant loss. I'm sure that even though that day was okay, there were other really hard days, but that you felt like you had the resources and support that you needed.
Yeah, it's interesting because basically cried when we lost $1 million, and then my dad came home that day. We were living with him at the time. We lost $1 million on some business, our own money, my co-founder and I. And I was literally not bawling, but I was in tears telling him about it. He's like, "You didn't cry when your mom died." I'm like, what is this? He's like, this doesn't matter. It's not that important.
Puts it in place.
Yeah. So that was interesting. It's definitely shaped me. I think it definitely puts all the resilience stuff in place for sure. I wouldn't say we've ever been in a position where we've been close to broke in terms of money. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason is, like, it's interesting. My father would always be there to invest in even the businesses when we're starting them out. And he didn't even care if he got his money back, but we always gave his money back and considered it a loan. But he was always ready to give us that mm-hmm. if we needed it. He'd even be ready today. I say, hey, Dad, I need a couple $100,000 because I got to go do this thing. Cool, here.
Always has your back.
Literally no questions asked. At the same time, I don't want to disappoint him, so he always gets his money back. Every single time he got his money back. We lost $1 billion. That was our money. Some of it might have been his. I don't remember, but it was all our money. But every single penny we've ever taken from him in that context of business, he's always gotten back.
Huh.
Right? So I think he just knew it. Come back. I don't think he cared, but like
made you to be a good investor.
I think so. That was kind of interesting.
Who else encouraged you as an entrepreneur?
I'm gonna say nobody.
Nobody else stands out. Not a teacher.
Not comparable to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that's hard to beat.
Hard to beat. I don't seek out mentors like that because I feel like I have the answer, but the answer is somewhere within.
Mm-hmm.
So if I need it, I'll just get information from people mm-hmm. for the most part.
Or seek a conversation that helps you to unlock what's in there.
Yeah, and less so someone to encourage me to do that, because I think his encouragement was more than enough. Like, it was probably an extreme form of encouragement from what I can tell.
Yeah.
Now that I unpack it. And I don't know why he did it.
Hmm.
I have no idea.
What's your dad's name?
Nitin, Nitin.
So it's like a really amazing man.
Yeah, he's awesome.
I'm glad for you that you had him.
Yeah. Me too.
Probably you more than me, but
No. I know what you mean.
Like, those stories go different ways.
Yeah.
There's been some interesting literature recently about the importance of telling family stories.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that a couple times, how your dad's a big storyteller and told lots of stories about,
especially growing up,
India and Africa and who he was and his adventures.
Even things he did, yeah.
I think some of the literature about it talks about how to help form a really foundational identity.
Yeah.
By when kids are little, just through stories, which are engaging and interesting and fun, they're learning that the world is open and interesting and fun. And yeah. I kind of hear a lot of that.
Yeah,
too,
I mean,
one
of the early stories was, like, he was on a plane going to England, and this happened like 3 or 4 times. And he'd be the first one when they say, is there a doctor in the plane? First one to raise his hand, I'm a doctor. What's the problem? Right? Like, he saved some lady's life once on the plane, and he'd tell all those stories. Mm-hmm. He'd, like, specifically come home and just talk about it. Not even to brag, just like, this is what happened.
This is what happened in my life.
Yeah. The only reason I know that he applied for 1,000 jobs is because he's talked about it, right, in the context of, here's how I got to America. There's all these other things, like, you know, like random ones, like, oh, you know, that office was closing at 6 p.m. and if we didn't get that, we wouldn't have made it to America and I wouldn't got that job, and like all these.
I feel like the story under the story is anything is possible.
Basically.
Like, with enough effort and a little bit of luck, like, it's all possible.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, what's interesting, and I don't know how to explain this. Maybe I do. Even when you say that, I've never heard him say anything like that to me. Like what you just said, ever. Like, never,
he's not,
like,
preaching.
Yeah, never, like, oh, anything's possible, kid. Never anything like that, ever. Not a single one of those.
I had this English teacher, and I think this is common, but she used to say all the time, in your writing, show, don't tell.
Yeah.
Like, show me. Don't tell me your point.
Yeah.
Like, make it come alive.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's sort of like.
That's what it is.
What's your dad's doing?
Never told me anything. Nothing like
that. He didn't tell you to be a helpful, moral person. He showed you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it was.
The best kind of mentoring.
I think so. And I think that's why, like, I probably get turned off when I see a lot of, like, not contextual advice and stuff like that.
Mm.
His advice was always contextual if I asked for it. Like, even today, like, somebody came up to me earlier today, and they're like, hey, I have low traffic. Like, what should I do? And, like, it's sort of in passing. And I already started feeling bad because I was giving him somewhat generic advice because I don't know why I was, but I think he needed to hear something more generic. But, like, normally, like, if someone asks me that, I've got, like, 100 questions to ask them before I got anything for them.
Right. It's like, let's sit down.
Yeah.
We need to take the time so I can help you properly.
Yeah. I mean, when you have low traffic on a site, generally it's like, figure out how to get more traffic, right? So we got to it, and he gave me the context, but, like, it's probably created some frameworks in my head around like when I hear people just give advice, like it just makes me close to angry when I either think it's wrong or think it's like not contextual or prescriptive generic stuff. It just makes me mad, actually. Mm. I don't know why. I think it's related to this stuff because like I never got advice like that from him.
You never got the one line, anything is possible, kid. You got deep, consistent.
Yeah, but never like a lesson. Not even a lesson in it. That's what was weird. Like, even if he said it, he's like, he never said like, oh, I did that, and here's a lesson for you.
Told the story and like figured it out.
Now that I think back at it, like, it's like you said, show not tell, but he never tried to tell me anything.
Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying this conversation. I feel like it makes me want to parent my kids a little bit differently in the sense of like...
This is why I give him a hard time.
Trusting who they are.
Yeah.
He has always, it sounded like, trusted in you really deeply. Whether it's giving you the screwdriver when you're five or the hospital computer when you're eight.
And I got in a lot of trouble. Like,
but it was never the kind of trouble that you can't get out of.
I think there's no trouble you can't get out of. And
there is some trouble you can't get out of.
I'll tell you that. Yeah, you're right. So I think I've never gotten in trouble I couldn't get out of. But I've also gotten in the kind of trouble where, like, a lot of other people wouldn't have been able to get out of. Without going into details, I've definitely gotten in so much trouble independently that I caused myself that was very difficult to get out of.
Mm, you had to work your way.
Yeah. Never money trouble, but definitely all kinds of trouble. Yeah. And even, like, if you think about that, then there's all this trouble that I could have got into that I didn't.
Yeah.
So I think that, but he never cared. Not in the way that, my father-in-law would have cared. Right.
And it sounds like it's, like, another distinction between caring more about who your kids are than what they do.
I think so.
It sounds like he wasn't terribly preoccupied with what you did with your days and the kinds of things you tried and the shenanigans you did, but whether he preached it or not, cared a lot about who you were.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me. Speaking of trouble, we're going to get in trouble if we're too late for the dinner. So, well, I'm going to get in trouble.
I'll get in trouble. That'll be my fault. Oh, yeah,
4:37. Cool. Yeah. Thanks a lot. What an interesting conversation.
Told you it was going to be interesting.
Your dad is awesome.
Yeah, he's...
And that's you. That's you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder. Our theme song is A New Beginning by bensound.com, used under Creative Commons.